Pete Peter, Representative Pete Peterson, Representative Chris Tuck, Commissioner Bryce Edgman, and myself, Representative Millet. Today we're going to hear a overview of Cook Inlet Gas from the Division of Oil and Gas, Kevin Banks, and Julie, how do you say your last
Hool.
Name? Hool. So we'll get started, and after that we'll have a presentation from Chugach Electric after we are done with your presentation. So thank you. Thank you for being here. Just for the record, just identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, I'm Kevin Banks. I'm the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and when you and I spoke almost a couple of months ago now, you asked if we could do some kind of presentation that would drill into the history of oil and gas in the Cook Inlet. In the materials that we will be working from today, we will have some references to the history going way back to 1890, but I'm not going to go into much depth than that, and rather I think it would be better if Julie first takes us through a bit of a discussion about the resource and potential and what the geology is like of the Cook Inlet, and then I'll take over again and talk a little bit more about the state of the supply situation today and in the Cook Inlet, and the discussion a little bit about some aspects of the market here in the Cook Inlet with respect to deliverability, the kinds of swings in demand and peak demand, and give you folks a sort of a sense of some of the issues that we're going to be dealing with as we go forward.
Okay, Kevin, so during the presentation, is it okay to ask questions? I think we'll probably have some questions, or do you want us to wait? What would be easier for you?
I think it's fine, and that way we'd be sure to answer questions as they come up and people don't.
Okay, and joining us, we have Representative Nancy Dahlstrom and Representative Jay Ramirez, so thank you.
So with that, Julie, would you put yourself on the record?
My name is Julie Hool. I'm the Resource Evaluation Section Chief for the Division of Oil and Gas. I work for Kevin. And my charge today is to present the geology of Cook Inlet from a geologist's point of view, exploration point of view for future gas potential. And I'm going to start with a couple slides out of order because Kevin's going to use them again later in the presentation. So I'd like to start with slide 45 to keep everybody awake this afternoon.
Is Kyle going to be there?
No. Okay. Sorry, we're going to move so we can see
you. Oh, you don't want me to. Usually I'm in a room with the laser in my safety hazard. And I'm going to look at this from an exploration geologist point of view, is what does the future hold for Cook Inlet gas exploration? And yes, the explorationist geologist, we think that there's more gas to be found in Cook Inlet, and we think it's going to be found both in existing fields and in new exploration play types, because as you'll see as a map of where the fields are, most of the fields have been that have been developed were on the major structures that you could find in the 60s with 2D seismic, and now we're going to need to go on to stratigraphic plays that are much more subtle and require much better seismic than they had back then, require 3D seismic. And then the hurdles, I'm just going to talk about land access briefly and the data gathering and drilling costs, then I'm going to let Kevin deal with the complicated limited market from the commercial point of view. And then if you could turn to slide 42. Basically, 85% of the gas discovered in Cook Inlet, like I mentioned, was while drilling for oil on large structures. Since the gas sits on top of the oil, the gas was encountered en route to drilling for an oil prospect on large structures, large anticlines. The strat trap are much more subtle, require three-dimensional seismic, and that is very much an undeveloped resource right now in Cook Inlet. And four of the largest fields in Cook Inlet hold 86% of the reserves. So the big fields are the major gas producers. And then I'm going to do out of order one more time. I'm going to go to the activity map on slide 17. And hopefully you can read it, but Marie brought, there's a copy with a two-sided 11 by 17. One of them has the Cook Inlet activity map, and the other one has the history of Cook Inlet development. And I'm going to actually read from my map, too, on this. I'll just briefly go over what the five largest producing fields are, and it's probably better if you look at your map. But the Beluga River unit, its annual production last year was around 43 BCF. Interestingly enough, almost all the wells that are producing in Beluga River right now were drilled pre-2005. Conoco did drill two wells in Cook Inlet this past year, and they're not online yet. But basically, almost all the production right now coming from Beluga was from wells drilled pre-2005. The second largest field is North Cook Inlet for gas, and its 2008 annual production was about 23 BCF. And again, almost 100% of its production is coming from wells drilled pre-2005. They drilled three wells there last winter that are last year that are not online yet. And then same thing with Trading Bay unit. It's also an oil field, but there's also gas being produced, 23 BCF. Almost all its wells were drilled pre-2005. Then the two that's I would like to hit my point on is the Nanilchik field down here. It's produced 19 BCF last year. Almost half its field, half its wells, 46%, were drilled between 2005 and 2008. And Marathon and Chevron Unocal have gone through the Nanilchik area. It's an anticline. It has a surface structure. There were several participating areas that they've combined. There's Paxton, there's Go, there's forgetting the name of the other one, but Susan Dion, and they've been systematically drilling, and the new wells they've been putting online have been adding reserves. And that's an example I'll show you a picture of, where if you drill within an existing field, they're developing it. They're doing a good job of adding reserves incrementally, well by well at a time. And just one other point I'd like to clarify in terms of talking about development and exploration wells, because we've had some misunderstanding in the past. We take the AOGCC definition from their regs, the 20 AAC 25.990, and when we talk about development wells on this diagram and exploration, we follow their definition. Their exploratory wells means a well drilled to discover or delineate a pool. So as I'll show you in a picture in a minute, if you drill one well, which Kevin will get into the history, when you drill one well, say in the 60s, and you had a discovery of gas or oil, then but nobody did anything because it wasn't economic, later when another company came in, and they drilled another well to delineate it to see how big it was, because the sands are discontinuous, then maybe it was commercially brought it online. But if you look at some of these discovery dates, they're way earlier than the field came online. And Cosmo is an example of that. The Stristikoff well was drilled, I believe, in the 60s. And then Conoco came back about 5-6 years ago and drilled a well. Actually, it was Arco. And then so they visited the areas. And there's a lot on that chart, Kevin will talk about, that are like that. And then the fifth largest producing gas area is the Kenai gas field that's been in production for a long time. It's on federal land. And it's about half of its wells that are producing, again, were 46%, were drilled between 2005 and 2008. And their annual production is around 19 billion cubic feet of gas. So with that, now I'll explain how go into the geology, so you have a context of the oil and gas, predominantly the gas, and I'll just go into my geology mode. And I can just do slideshow, right, Kevin? Mm-hmm. View show.
I think that's Chris's.
Okay. As everyone is very well aware with the activity of Readout just west of Kenai, we live in a very active geologic area of the world. And I'm sure most of you have heard of the Ring of Fire, all the volcanoes that are here. The interesting thing about Cook Inlet is it's a oil and gas producing province in an area that has active volcanism. And what's important about that is usually volcanic rocks that will form the sandstone are not very good reservoir rocks to be a container for oil and gas. And I'll explain why Cook Inlet is unique in that way, why they actually work that way. So if we go to the next slide here, we are in an active subduction zone, the Chugach Mountains. We have the Cook Inlet Basin, and then we have the Ring of Fire, all the volcanoes coming on. The subduction zone here, that's actually the slab of earth that's going down, it's a lot heavier. It contains mafic minerals, iron, magnesium, and that's why it slides under the continental crust, which has more quartz type minerals in it. And so that's why the physics works that way. But then you have the volcanoes erupting, and you have that. I'll show you in the next slide. If you see this Cook Inlet Basin right here and the volcanoes right there, if you go to the next slide, you can see that's the volcanic area. This is the Cook Inlet Basin. And then this, what's called a Four Arc Basin here, is where the sediments are deposited. And the other interesting thing about Cook Inlet is you've got source area with the volcanics coming from the western side, and then you have this, I'm sure most of you have hiked in the Chugach Mountains, but if you've looked at the rocks, some are sedimentary, some are slightly metamorphosed, slate, phyllite type rocks, and they then get worked this way. The primary depositional fabric in Cook Inlet are fluvial, they're rivers, and the area coming off the volcanic arc are very coarse-grained alluvial fans, and they're coming from the west and depositing to the east. And then you have a system of a river system, very highly meandering river system that comes through along the basin axis. And you also have tectonics going on. You have faulting, active faulting. You have subsidence where the ground is lowering in level. And you have these two type of rock types coming together, and I'll show you later what that looks like in terms of rock quality. But you also, the thing of to take home message about the sandstones in Cook Inlet is they're very discontinuous. They're below seismic resolution, which is roughly about 150 feet. These sands at the thickest are 70 feet. And it depends which zone you're in, which ones they are. So you, in terms of picking them up on seismic, it's below seismic resolution. 3D seismic will probably give you a better idea of how to delineate them, but you're chasing sands that are pretty thin and pretty discontinuous.
Thank you. Can I just jump and ask a question about the seismic activity? You mentioned earlier that most of the gas explored to date had been the product of 2D. seismic
correct
activity.
In the 60s, when they were mapping the areas, you could see the large anticlinal structures on 2D seismic, because they're very large structures. They run all the way up and down this way in Cook Inlet, and you'll see, if you look on your activity map, the fields all line up along pretty much the structural trend of those anticlines.
So Madam Chair, so where are we today with 3D exploration work relative to gas deposits?
I would say in the North Slope it's much more of a tool, but the sedimentary depositional environment is different. There were three 3D surveys in Cook Inlet: the Beluga Field, the Ninilchik area, and there was one more over North Cook Inlet. They were over existing fields, and the advantage there is they have a lot of well control in order to look at their seismic and see the correlation between the sands in the wells, because they're very closely spaced with the seismic, and then they can get an idea of what's going on. But in terms of somebody going in, shooting a 3D seismic in an area, say they have a model in mind, in terms of Cook Inlet, that's what we would like to see. And a good example of somebody doing that would be Chevron up in the White Hills on the North Slope, where they have an idea of what they want to do. They've shot seismic, and they've committed to a 5 to 8 well program, where they're not just going to say, well, if one well doesn't work out, I'm going to, you know, fold my tent. They're actually drilling successive wells to test out their idea. And it's going to take someone in Cook Inlet with money and a lot of fortitude and, you know, courage to keep going and looking for these subtle stratigraphic traps. This is a view of the streams, just a plan view if you were flying over the Susitna Valley. And it shows you the discontinuous nature of, you would have a sand deposited in the stream here, and over time you can see these sands building up. This one time the river went here, then it moved over to here, and then it moved over there, and all these areas here are deposits of sand, linear deposits. And if they end up being on top of each other, we call it amalgamated. That means the sands are thicker and they're easier to spot on seismic, and they're better reservoirs because they're thicker as opposed to isolated sands. And also the thing about Cook Inlet with this type of environment, there are a lot of coals, and coals wreak havoc on seismic interpretation because they mess up your reflectors, and they it's very hard not only to drill there, but also the coals mess up your interpretation. Oh, there's a crevasse blade, point bars, different types of depth environment. And this is how a company would go in. This is an example from the Beluga field Bob Swenson worked up, where actually the company had sands, they had closely spaced wells, and they were able to figure out the thickness of the sands and whether they were in communication or not, whether they were the same sand. And a lot of times how they tell that is that the pressure of the sand, if the pressure in the sand is the same in one well as the next, they say, well, that was probably in communication. But you can see that all sands don't hit all wells, and you really need close control in order to figure out what's in communication and good engineering information on pressure. And you can see here is 50 feet. So if you can see seismic resolution is 150 feet, you're seeing you're going through several sands in the course of your what you can see on seismic.
Can I ask another question?
Mm-hmm. What was that,
Ezra? In terms of doing 3D seismic activity, how does that all play out with the Beluga issue?
I can show you where the Beluga, I have a map that shows the Beluga on there, and that is an issue. And the problem with shooting seismic is not only the habitat issue, but also you have the tides. So when you're trying to shoot, you have to you get a lot of problems. You can only shoot certain times with the tide. That's just a map of the basin showing the thickness is right in here. I think the max is around 25,000 feet. This is the stratigraphy of Cook Inlet, and I only just do the three that are the most producing, is the Sterling, the Beluga, the Tyonic, and somewhat the Hemlock. The Hemlock is oil prone, the Tyonic oil in the lower, and then gas in the upper, and then Beluga and Sterling are most exclusively gas. The one reflector you can really see well in the Cook Inlet is the Sterling to Beluga transition. And that's because the Sterling sands are much thicker. The packages, the sandstone packages of the rivers are, they deposited on top of each other. We call that accreted. So they became thicker. You can see those kind of outcrops, Sterling and Upper Beluga, if you've been like near Clam Gulch. You've seen those big sandy cliffs. There's not a lot of coal in Sterling either. It's a very good reservoir. Beluga is thinner bedded, it has more coal, and it's also a good gas reservoir, but it's not as thick bedded as the Sterling. And then the Tyonic is also has a lot of coals and variable sand thickness. This is why I was about the discontinuous nature of the sands. You can see that one well would not necessarily penetrate every sand on a structure. So if you just did your one well for discovery, you would want to drill several others to delineate the actual size of what your reservoir is, because some of these sands are not continuous. And then you might drill into another sand and think, oh, it's a different sand, but then by the pressure you've gotten from this well, you know that they're in communication. So discontinuous nature of the sands makes the gas sands, you could go back in a field and drill in between wells, and you could actually get more gas. And we call that bypass pay. And then also in some of the wells, the perfs are so old, they're plugged up, that if you went in there and did some work on your well again, you could get gas going. But the old, especially the older wells, if you don't keep producing them, if you shut them in, most of them will water out and you won't get them restarted again. So that's why once you drill a well in Cook Inlet, you want to keep it producing, because shutting it in, especially an older well, is generally you're going to have problems and may not even be able to open it up again for gas. This is an example. I'll go through a few quickly with seismic. This would be the early stages of development in Cook Inlet where they had seismic, and you can see the large structures, and that's what the major fields were discovered on. Middle Ground Shoal, Beluga, Tyonok. If you look on again on your activity map, you can see that them lining up with where the fields are. These large structures have been all discovered, so that would be your first order of what you would look for gas, and those have been discovered. The next one, which Bob calls low-hanging fruit, are associated with structures or on the side of structures. They have three-way closure, but you have to really do some mapping to see if you've got that fourth side of your closure. And that's a good exploration target to see if you can find an area where there's slight rollover, there's a strat trap with maybe shale or coal on top that's going to trap your gas. So that's an exploration type that could be, we could see more in Cook Inlet. This is a flat spot, which is where if you hit a gas-filled zone, it can be, it slows down your seismic. The time traveled will slow down in the gas, and you see these flat spots. That can be an indicator of gas. Again, it can or cannot. It may or may not be, but that's a good place to look for gas also. And then this is just briefly review here. The basic anticline structures have been discovered, and those were easy to find on seismic, 2D seismic. The fault traps, there are some that have been discovered. Some are likely more to be discovered where you have trapped up against a fault. The strat trap here is the most elusive, and it really requires very good 3D seismic and processing in order to find these things. It takes persistence, and you have to have a model in mind. But once you get the pattern, you can have a lot of success. This is the type that we're talking about in Cook Inlet that needs that you could find more gas with. It's more elusive, but we're confident that they're there. And you see the subtle strat traps on seismic. You just have to follow a line, find a little pinch out, and you just have to go through. And also with 3D seismic, there's a lot of attributes. There's what we call AVO, amplitude versus offset, and there's just a lot of parameters you can play with to see what might work in these areas, different seismic attributes. I just wanted to show here that the Cook Inlet sands have a lot of volcanics in them, especially in the Tyonok and the Beluga. And the reason why they generally look good is because they're young, they're less than 65 million years old, and they have not been compacted because they're less than 10,000 feet deep. The deeper you compact them, it's kind of like toothpaste. It squeezes out, it fills the pore space. You get water from the formations going through there. You get what we call diagenetic effects that cement up the rock. and then you don't have a reservoir rock anymore.
Madam Chair?
Representative Tuck?
I'm not sure what I'm looking at right there. First, I thought they were forgetting not talking about volcanic ash.
Okay.
Is it is this a seismic reading, or is this a sample, or what are the pictures? I'm
Representative
sorry.
Tuck, through the chair, this is a piece of a rock that was slabbed a couple microns, and then it you look at it under a microscope, and then you take a picture of it, and those are little pictures of rock fragments that are part of a sandstone. I apologize for that. We get into our field and we forget that. Yeah. So, and these blue areas in here are porosity. So that would be where your oil would move through and or your gas and be stored. So Cook Inlet, even though there are volcanics in it, the fact that it's buried less than 10,000 feet, it's still a good reservoir. And I've already gone through that. Just briefly go through these. The Cook Inlet Basin, this is a map of thickness. The thickest is in here, 25,000 feet, and you get shallower as you go to the edges. The main fields are lined up along here. And I'll just go briefly through land access issues in Cook Inlet. So this is the entire Cook Inlet Basin. These are the fields, and you can see they line up with the anticlinal trends. Now you add on what is federal land, and that's in the brown. Then you add on the purple, which is Siri land. Then you add on the green, which is mental health land. And the red is the beluga habitat that I think Representative Edgeman was talking about. This came out in our latest best interest findings for Cook Inlet. Then you look at the part of the basin that is under lease sales, and that's what's been leased with the state acreage. And you can see the area with North Cook Inlet, Beluga, and Trading Bay is pretty much leased up. The sweet spot in Cook Inlet, right in there, is pretty much all. You also notice this kind of bite in here, which is federal land, where Swanson River and Kenai gas field are. And then you look at this trend of oil here. You've got the Ninilchik anticline, which Marathon and Unocal are producing gas. You look up, you keep going. You think, this might be perspective because I've got a trend here of gas and oil. My trend should continue up through Point Possession, Fire Island. So that land is potential resource, but not available.
Could you do those overlays one more time?
Sure.
Bryce just wants to, Representative Edgeman wants to look.
Yeah.
Just the slower side of the committee table here.
Yeah, that's okay. This is a isopach map of the basin that shows how thick the sands are in total, the whole sedimentary package of sand, shales, coals. And the thickest of it is around 25,000 feet right in here.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes up and it's zero at this line. And that shows you the total sediment thickness right there of the basin. Then you add on where the fields are for Cook Inlet, and you've got middle ground shoal. And if you look at your map of the Cook Inlet activity, you can see where those line up. You've got Ninilchik, you've got Kenai, you've got Swanson. Then you go to the federal acreage, the Moose Range and all. Then you go to Siri, the land they have. And then you go to the mental health lands. And then you go to the beluga habitat. And then you go to what's available for area-wide leasing for the state. Then you go what the state has leased in blue, currently leased. You can see a lot of the wells, the fields in there are in the area all leased up. And I guess that's the last one. So I'll turn it over to Kevin.
Great. Stick around, Julie, you might have more questions.
You want me to switch seats with you? You want me to drive?
Oh, that'd be good, thanks.
Give you the thing back, though.
Thank you, Julie, for that. And the next slide is the introduction to the history of Cook Inlet exploration and development. And I'm going to just skip right over that. There's a rather good timeline in here. Basically, activity or interest in the Cook Inlet began right at the beginning of, you know, in the early, in the late 19th century, but more importantly, in 1955, there was a discovery of gas at Swanson River on federal lands. There was a lot of activity and trading leases among private parties at that point. And then by 1958, Swanson oil production began, and that actually helped trigger statehood, because we had proved up a potential resource that would sustain the economy of Alaska. Perhaps a better way of looking at how the state's development has occurred over time appears on slide 38. And here you can see that since 1950, the kind of activity for exploration in the Cook Inlet has occurred. There was a great big peak in the 60s where most of the large oil developments were found. That was the target. Oil was found in those large fields. And gas was found as a byproduct of that kind of exploration. It was not the target for development in those days. What happened as a consequence of that is that in the late 60s, the producers in the Cook Inlet had to figure out a way of monetizing their gas resources. So we saw the Agrium plant built by Unocal, the LNG facility constructed by ConocoPhillips and Marathon, or ARCO in those days, and then finally to absorb the market, to create a market for gas that was needed in order to be able to monetize a resource that they had discovered, in a sense, by accident. Now, this graphic also shows that we've seen some more activity in the last 10 years or so, and much of the targets now in red are gas. So as oil production has declined and the need for more gas has presented itself, we're seeing a lot more exploration for gas. And again, exploration is defined not only as a drilling for a wildcat well in an unknown area, but includes drilling to delineate gas in existing in an area where gas is known to exist, because it had been explored before. Development wells this is the kind of wells that are drilled for production. They're not necessarily used to try to determine whether there's new gas available. And there's been a fairly steady development of gas and oil after seeing a peak in the 60s again. And if we look at the platform position, the offshore platforms in the Cook Inlet, most of them were put in place in the 60s. And the last time Force Energy built the Osprey platform, it's an oil platform also in 2000. This is a bar graph to illustrate what kind of leasing activity we've seen over the years. There's been a fairly steady number of acres purchased by potential production and exploration companies. I would say that at the moment, of all the state land available in the Cook Inlet, about 25% of it is under lease. And it would be fair to say, I think that represents the best state land available. People will select land, obviously, where they think there's the most likelihood of finding gas. And it suggests to me that we have a real need now to see if we can't bring more land into, or get greater access to land, say in the Kenai Wildlife Refuge, or land owned by other owners.
Representative Edgman?
Thank you. Just so I'm tracking what's going on here in the conversation, when was the beluga habitat established relative to this timeline here?
We've, right now, I think it would have been within the last 2 years. The Fish and Wildlife Service, I believe, has laid out critical habitat areas that have certain kinds of restrictions. Just recently, of course, the beluga was listed as an endangered species. That may change how the critical habitat is managed. We don't know yet, but at the moment, that the land that was illustrated in the graphic that Julie was showing you has been laid out basically in the last couple of years.
Okay. Madam
Representative Edgman?
I'm just trying to get some sense here. I'm not trying to make a statement by any means at all, but I'm just trying to get some sense of what this means to the Cook Inlet area in terms of gas exploration, seismic activity.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, what it'll mean is that access to those areas will, in some instances, be completely prevented or prohibited. So areas in the north end of the Cook Inlet, say north of the North Cook Inlet unit, north of Possession Point, will be off limits. For other areas, it'll be some kind of seasonal restriction, perhaps, because it lies at the mouth of rivers where there's likely to be feeding going on. And so there'll be requirements, I suspect, for conflict avoidance and activities associated with seismic or drilling offshore will have to be work around the presence of whales in the area. That's a hopeful.
When was the last time that some 3D seismic was shot out in the inlet?
3D seismic was done in, as Julie said, at North Cook Inlet and at the Beluga River, I think, last year.
And
in Ilchik also. And some of the challenges of that is that as you get into shallower water and with the tides and so forth, the resolution of the seismic gets a little confused and is more difficult to interpret. This graph, it actually shows up better, I think, in our handout. What this graph represents is a distribution of all of the fields in the Cook Inlet by their size. So the smallest fields are on the left and the largest ones are on the right. As you would expect in nature, you find a lot of little things and you find a few big things. But in the in your handout, there's a wedge with a question mark in it between about 300 million cubic feet to about 1.2 billion cubic feet of gas, which represents where we would expect to find more gas fields in order to round out the picture of what normally you find in a basin or an area, an oil and gas basin. So our expectations are that that as more gas is found, it could very well exist in this area. And as Julie mentioned, in the Ninilchik unit, if you add together the three different participating areas there, you'd land somewhere in the middle of that wedge. With a field like that. And so in the future, we hope that drilling and exploration would yield some more of those gas fields in that range. And there you go. That's the area that we're talking about. Julie's coaching me a bit, but it's an important point. We were talking about land access. Cosmopolitan is an oil and gas field. It has an oil field with a gas cap on it. Because of restrictions and the inability to gain access to the Cosmopolitan unit from the surface in the Cook Inlet, and instead it's being drilled directionally from onshore, it means that those wells will be drilled underneath the gas cap. And so while oil will be produced there, because the reservoir is so shallow and the deviation of the wells is so extreme, it means that we can't reach the gas in Cosmopolitan unless you could put a platform on top of it. The problem, there's resource conflicts that will make that very difficult to do. mostly with respect to fishing and the corridor that's used by the salmon as they're coming up the Cook Inlet and the whales that follow them. So we started at this slide, and I'll wrap it up around here too. We have shown you before, and to the legislature before, graphs about Cook Inlet production and the potential for future reserves. This graphic represents a kind of a combination of things, so bear with me as I try to explain it. In the past, we've shown what we in-house refer to as the waterfall or the cliff that would show what our reserve capacity has for producing, developing, and potential gas within existing units and being produced from existing wells. And that represents that red dotted line. It shows that we fall off fairly dramatically from some point in the present. And it's based on an assumption that no further investments are made in the inlet, that gas is produced from existing wells only as without any further development. The history line, the red line identified there as history, represents an annual average production of gas. The capacity of the inlet at any given point is actually much greater than that, because in any given, and if I can refer to the slide that follows that, you can see that on very cold days, it is the potential production can be much, much greater than the average. So, for example, in 99, one of the coldest days of the year, about 763 million cubic feet of gas was delivered to the market. That included the LNG plant and Agrium in those days. By 07, Agrium had gone down, but there was still deliveries of gas to the LNG plant. You had a number of 500, and then by just last January, with the LNG plant down to about its getting close to its minimum consumption of gas, and with a fair amount of gas coming out of storage, we hit numbers of 380 on that cold day. But if we look back at our slide here, in 2009, the average production was 150 BCF a day, which is, I can't do the math in my head, but that's quite a bit less than the 380 maximum theoretical capacity, which is represented by the blue line. Now, there's another, on this graph, I've also included a black line that is our forecasted demand. We have to account for the fact that Excel draws graphs with slanted lines in places where it probably should be vertical, but it represents for 2009 through 2011 that there will be LNG exports allowed to the tune of about 49 BCF a year, and then this graphic assumes that the LNG exports will not continue after that point, so you get a straight line of forecasted demand at just below 100 BCF a year in total demand. In the yellow on this graph is a couple of kinds of resources. Engineers will refer to them as P2 reserves. It means, I've heard people express it as behind the pipe reserves, so this is gas in those discontinuous sands that have not been reached by the existing wells, so that more drilling in existing fields could produce as much as another 470 BCF of gas. There's actually these five wells that are referred to in the yellow box would represent some kind of a line in there, because they have not yet begun producing. So there might be some kind of decline curve within that yellow area that represents production from those five new wells. But there's also going to be the potential for more gas from continued development drilling in existing fields. and that would get us out to about 2019 if there were no LNG exports in order to supply the utility and electricity demand in the Cook Inlet. Now, we're going to try to refine these numbers much better. This is a our first shot at trying to get our arms around this, but it'll be necessary to do a little bit more work and to try to get a better handle on it. In the area to the left of that yellow, if gas is to be supplied into that market, it will come from brand new exploration and out of the resource that has not yet been discovered.
Kevin, I think Representative Peterson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have they used directional drilling or fracturing in Cook Inlet yet? Do you know?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, the answer to that is yes. I mean, for example, any platform, for example, you have only the wells are literally feet apart, and so in order to reach out into the throughout the field, you have to drill directionally to get to them. Horizontal wells, as we normally think about it, is not that common because you're trying to hit as many sand bodies as you can as you drill through the resource. The one point I wanted to make about this graphic is that this 470, well, let's say 400 to 500 BCF of gas will only be drilled for if there is a place to put the gas, if you find it. When it's brought online. So it really truly is a producer will not drill a well until they know that they have a place to sell it. And what we've seen in the past and is that a company, a producer will enter into a supply contract with a customer and meet the supply requirements for that customer by additional drilling as wells begin to decline and they add more gas. You can't expect them to go out and look for this kind of gas if there isn't a place, a market for it. If we were to assume that some kind of LNG exports were allowed beyond the next license period, say from 2011 into the future, some of the gas that would supply that LNG might come out of this yellow area at the expense of a 2019 deadline, or a period where we start dropping off. So as we start thinking about whether exports occur again, I think it would behoove the state to make sure that in our discussions with the exporters that they commit to replacing reserves, these kinds of reserves, with new reserves, and maybe, and then some, not just a one-for-one replacement, but maybe we can ask for more. One of the issues for the Cook Inlet, and we'll be wrapping it up fairly quickly here, is to recognize that because of the climate here, we have almost 14 times as much gas delivered into the market on needle peaking days than we do on the warm day in the summertime. And this means that gas has to come from somewhere during those very cold days. In the past, there was sufficient capacity in all of the fields to simply produce more gas from the existing wells or to add some compression and to pour it into the system. Now it's becoming a more of a delicate balancing act because the number of wells, the productivity of those wells, and the productivity of the fields in which they are drilled is such that a whole set of tools are needed in order to supply the market on those cold days. So line pack, for example, if we can anticipate a cold day, it's not uncommon for NSTAR to begin pumping gas into the pipelines so that there's a sufficient amount of gas there to be drawn out of it. They use the pipeline as a long, skinny storage tank. Gas storage, we've mentioned already, there are three in the inlet right now that are exhausted gas pools where gas is pumped into them during the warm summer days and then drawn out during the cold winter days. Added compression, more wells, and Also, swinging the load of gas taken up by LNG exports is a way of shifting gas supply to the market on very cold days. Now, that's physically how it works. How the market will deal with that is going to be a different question. And it is actually one of our challenges to see if there isn't some kinds of mechanisms to make the process more transparent. For example, that gas storage can be offered to third parties instead of a producer using their own storage for their own gas. Those kinds of market mechanisms are common in the lower 48, and I think there is a wonderful opportunity to have those sorts of things working here so that the market can respond as it should and in an efficient way of delivering gas to consumers. Again, the base load for heating and power is the difference between warm day and cold day swings is much greater for heating and power than it is when you throw in LNG and in days past the fertilizer plant. So reducing peak swing by having some kind of industrial or export use is actually a good thing. It keeps those wells online year-round and prevents the problem of watering out wells that Julie referred to earlier. So actually, I think I'm going to wrap it up here. There are a few more slides that talks about some of the details, but we've been sort of occupying the seat for an hour, and I don't want to belabor our privileges here. So I can take questions if you like.
Representative Ramos?
Thank you. Kevin, you're my favorite person in the state of Alaska government, just about. I think the world of you. And there's no but.
Okay.
Because I know you were waiting.
I was waiting.
I know you were. Your trust in me is so low. I want to thank you. Kevin sat next to me, Mr. Banks sat next to me on the airplane right after we visited Nome. And we CC'd all the members. He helped us craft a letter about the potential gas in the Norton Sound. He helped us craft a letter to himself, and then he responded, and then we sent those copies to the mayor of Nome. And we thank you very much for helping to articulate what's the possible and perhaps not the possible for Nome. I just want to thank you on the record for your assistance with all requests. Could I run a series of numbers by you and just tell me just in broad swings whether these are accurate or not? The Cook Inlet back in its heyday used to produce about 200,000 barrels of oil a day, and it's now down to about 10 or 20,000 barrels a day of production now. You're nodding your head. I think that's roughly accurate.
That is roughly. We're about 20,000 today, but you're right, about 220 at the peak, and now about 25.
And the price of gas, the sale price of gas 20, 30 years ago was somewhere around 15 cents an MCF, and the taxes on that gas were about 20 cents an MCF back in the 70s, I think, or even into the 80s. Is that right?
Representative Ramos, I don't know what the taxes were like, but taxes were 10% of the production tax. So, but the price of gas in the very old days was 15 cents probably. So that's probably an accurate statement.
And the difficulty now, Senator Terrio from my district, he likes to say, they're not out of gas in the Cook Inlet, they're just out of cheap gas. And so we were visiting with Armstrong the other night, who thinks they have found a potentially significant area to drill, but the cost of lifting that gas is $7 to $10, and we all know the RCA is not interested in permitting gas sales, you know, above some magic number that's, you know, tied to Henry Hub and other indices that are in the $3.85, $4 range, sometimes less than that $4 range. So we have the ability to find more gas, but we don't have the ability to find it at the historically attractive prices that the Cook Inlet has yielded over the last 40 years. Is that reasonably accurate?
Representative Ramos, through the chair, I think there's a couple things we can say about that. Exploration in the Cook Inlet is, in my opinion, going to be an expensive enterprise. I'd like to be able to provide you with much better information. You know, perhaps looking at some of the tax information that we're acquiring through ACES to get a handle on what onshore cost, drilling costs are like, perhaps working with our lessees or hiring in folks to look at what it would take to do drilling offshore. But my expectation is that it's quite a bit more expensive than it has been. And as Julie pointed out, in developing a stratigraphic play, there has to be a commitment and a willingness to move forward, even if your initial wells are not as bright and as successful as you'd hope. So there may be a real commitment to several wells before you've made the decision that you have a productive resource. But access is also an issue here, and I think we've demonstrated that most of the state lands that we offer every year has been pretty well picked over. And to the extent that we can get new lessees to develop our land, that's great, but I think we need to engage the federal government and others to see if we can get access to their land as well.
And then, if I may, Drew Pierce told me, the group I was with in D.C., and I'm not sure what she told you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, and I remember seeing Charlie Huggins, Senator Huggins' visceral reaction to her suggestion that at the Conoco plant we should go to the FERC and apply for a regas permit and consider importing LNG into the Cook Inlet. Can you take a couple of minutes to discuss the practicality of how that would change the basin if we, contemplated a regas facility, and what that would do, what that would, because your drawings suggest that the Conoco export facility may go away, but you didn't prepare a slide that suggested what kind of dynamic changes would happen to the basin if we got a regas certificate and to change the flow of the LNG facility, and what would happen. Now, I will say for the record that I'm not in favor of that. I'm a bullet line person, and that Senator Huggins said that he didn't think that Alaskans would tolerate that. And as the old cliche goes, it's not politically correct to use this word, I know, Madam Chair, but it would be like selling ice cubes to the Eskimos bring natural gas, to import it into Alaska. But can you talk for a little bit as the Director of Oil and Gas, what would happen if we pursued a strategy like that, if $3 or $4 gas was available through LNG and it was much less expensive than lifting $7 to $10 gas out of the basin, but kind of project forward what the ramifications would be on the basin if we did that?
Well, Representative Ramis, through the chair, if I may, I can only speak about this in kind of our economic theory and generalities. There is, I think, a situation right now with LNG exports where there is where, in a sense, the market for gas in Cook Inlet is attached to some other market in the world. And that occurs because the pricing for gas for export should have some influence on the price of gas within the basin. There's also an issue of how much it costs to develop gas here. That's a demand side kind of question, but on the supply side is the question, can people drill for gas and supply an export at the kinds of prices that you were talking about? So in a sense, depending on how transparent the market is in terms of sending price signals to producers and to consumers here, we are already hooked into an export market now, or a world LNG market to some extent. If gasification were permitted, it would be just another way for that connection to a world market would be established. And again, it depends on how transparent the pricing is and whether or not the signals of price function well through the marketplace. And Maybe it's, as you said, politically incorrect. Maybe we'll use Coles to Newcastle as an example. But if the energy for gas brought in from elsewhere is cheaper for the Alaska consumers than it would be to produce gas here from our own resources, well, I think it would be wrong for us to suggest that Alaskans pay a higher price for their gas. I mean, I think, like I said, that's probably an uncomfortable statement to make, but I think if that's what the market reality would look like, I think it's something that we need to pay attention to. Now, before that happens, I think there's a lot of other options out there, a lot of other things that can happen, including, you know, gas from the North Slope, successful exploration in the Cook Inlet for a price that is not so high that it can't compete with imports. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, when you talk about the price of a gas high in Cook Inlet, how do you see the state's role in helping sustain a lower price of gas in the inlet? Do you have some suggestions? I know we have a pretty aggressive incentives for exploration in Cook Inlet, but outside of that, how do you see the gas prices coming down in the inlet and making it, more affordable to drill?
Madam Chairman, that is a very good question, and I think we have fairly attractive tax provisions. We've provided for mechanisms in royalties so that there isn't some gotcha in the calculation of our royalty value with the way we treat gas sales to utilities. Aside from an outright subsidy of some sort for exploration activities, I haven't given it 100% of my time to think about. But I think, first of all, let's find out what is the potential for gas development and new drilling, and compare that to other options. I think is the role that I think DNR can take, is to help provide people like you with the kinds of information that it takes to, you know, pick the most cost-effective alternative to or new gas alternative for Cook Inlet.
And then can you just quick give us an update on Escapeda and the other groups that we had before the legislature? I think it was last fall that Danny Davis and...
I didn't ask that.
I did. we talked about it in my office, but I just thought it would be good to have it on record some of the things that have happened since you were last in front of the legislature on those explorers.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Shortly after the House Resources met on December 1st, I believe it was, we met with all of the parties, including ConocoPhillips, I might add. That would have been representatives from Renaissance, from Escapeda, and from Pacific Energy as well, and asked them to consider a solution that was more in keeping with the purposes of unitization, to form a unit on a piece of land where there's one owner and where there is somewhat undefined or amorphous potential for gas. It doesn't really satisfy the point. I mean, what a unit should do is, in addition to taking care of the rights of the various partners in such a place, is also to limit the requirements for facilities on the surface. And what we had was different companies each proposing to drill wells from different platforms or jackup rigs. And so we said, come back with a concept that would that you could share with us, where all of you are in some agreement about how a drilling program would be organized. Over the course of the last couple of months, some events have overtaken us, and Pacific Energy last week went into Chapter 11. Escapeda, the operator at the Kitchens unit, structured a deal in which it, somewhat like what Danny Davis said he would do in the hearing, was to acquire ownership interest in all of the leases of the other two, and has come forward with a plan of exploration or commitment to give us a plan of exploration for the area of all of these leases with real live drilling commitments. I think it's fair to say that while we haven't got the plan of exploration in hand yet, on a couple of occasions, Danny Davis has made the commitment that if he fails to meet those due dates, he will relinquish the leases, and then we can move on and find someone else.
Representative Ramirez.
Mr. Banks, I know it's a tremendous burden to be one of the steadiest voices in the state of Alaska, and I admire you so much for that. So I like asking you policy questions. On this slide, number 46, this suggests that we may continue to go to the Cook Inlet for gas supply, and that Conoco goes away, that the export piece goes away, I think. So my question is going the opposite direction from a policy point of view. What would happen if Harry Noah is successful, as I know that he will be, and we're bringing gas down from somewhere, Nenana, the North Slope, Gubik, somewhere, by 2014? Can you articulate what would happen to this basin if we are successful in building an in-state small diameter gas pipeline? What will happen to the Conoco gas, to the export piece? How long will the life of the basin as it's presently delineated last for, you know, if they can go back to, you know, maximizing the, I think they're at 50 BCF a year now, but they have an authorization to 75 BCF a year. Can you articulate what that future would look like if the in-state gas has its deal and then we still have the export piece going from the depleting Cook Inlet, the mature Cook Inlet field?
Well, Representative Ramos, through the chair, you're asking for a policy answer to a prediction, is what you've asked. It's not for a policy answer, but a prediction.
Well, what would happen? Carl Gatto does this all the time, and he gets answers.
Who does?
Representative Gatto does. He asks lots of questions. He's like, well, what if? So what if?
You know, you're asking me to speculate, and I think a bullet line has the impact of either they use the existing export facility to export gas, in which case you've limited the market for some of this yellow and future exploration gas in the Cook Inlet. The question is, can the Cook Inlet compete with gas from the North Slope? Perhaps there's a requirement for some new use of gas in the Cook Inlet as a consequence of a pipeline from the North Slope. I don't know. It depends on how much it's going to cost to get gas into the South Central region and how North Slope gas competes with the existing resources here.
Sorry, just very quickly, I don't think you understood my question. I must not have stated it quite right. What I meant to say is that if the state is consuming the 500B or the 500 MCF small diameter line, and you have the existing gas in the depleted field, how long will it last if you continue to export the same quantity of gas? Is there 10 years worth of gas, 20, 30 years? If you relieve the Cook Inlet of the burden of providing gas to South Central, because it's now handled by the gas supply, and you don't, you know, have a lot of exploration because of the cost in Cook Inlet, and you just concentrate on an annual export out of the Cook Inlet, how long would it last for? 20 years, 30 years, 50 years? I think that's with the existing gas that's in the basin.
Well, I if I understand the question, if you don't produce the gas, it's always going to be there. And if North Slope gas comes down,
I'll ask you after that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I think it's, I will say one thing. It behooves us to explore a lot of different options here before we make big decisions about how much, you know, what investments to make if the state is going to participate in various solutions here. And I think having a better understanding of the resource potential and the cost of development of gas in the Cook Inlet is a part of that research.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me ask you a question, Mr. Banks, that I think you probably have a more definite answer for. On one of the slides that you didn't talk about, it said there are gas storage expansion plans. How much storage is that, and when is that happening?
Representative Peterson, through the chair, the we today have, as I mentioned, three facilities that are operated by producers who own the gas that they're putting in storage. We have had discussions already begun with another applicant for a gas storage lease, and I think indications are that that applicant is interested in creating storage for third-party use. So it's providing a commercial service, mm-hmm. which I think is a really great idea. There are other gas fields in the Cook Inlet that could serve as storage. Their location sometimes is the wrong side of the inlet. We would prefer to see some more on the west side where the transportation capacity is a little bit easier to utilize. But the without saying, I've seen a list of 5, 6, 7 more potential storage pools that we could use. These are exhausted gas pools.
Okay, thank you.
Additional questions for Representative Dahlstrom? I'm biding time until the real chair of the committee comes to the table. Perfect entrance.
Oh, good. Did you finish up? Sorry.
Yes. That's
okay.
All right. Thank you for.
Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you. I do have just one quick question. Julie, in the very beginning, you referenced a statute that was the definition of a well. Can you give me that again? Okay, that'd be perfect.
Yeah,
okay. Maybe I will ask that.
Oh, thanks so much.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I have one more question from Representative Edgman, and we still have two guests to do a quick presentation after you get done, so go ahead.
Okay, I'll try to frame this so it's a fairly concise question that requires a quick, concise response.
Best.
We heard from the Armstrong group a few days ago, and I just happened to find my notes, so basically what an attempt to give us a general perspective of sort of the promising nature of natural gas findings in the inlet. Mr. Kerr, he compared Cook Inlet to the Bighorn to the San Juan, just sort of geographical areas. And very quickly, the wells drilled in Cook Inlet for natural gas, obviously, are very small, less than 14. Bighorn was over 100, and San Juan was 984. And I think the tenor of his message was one of sort of promise, potential, and sort of underexplored areas and whatnot, all the while sort of couching it with the reality that it's expensive to drill and so forth. But the presentation I've heard today sort of gives you more of a subdued message, or maybe more of a sort of a grounding that there's maybe some opportunity out there, but there's also some real challenges that need to be overcome as well. But in just a short few sentences, would you agree with my characterization of your presentation today as such?
Well, Representative Edgman, I'm a pretty low-key sort of fellow. I actually think that if I've given you a message that is pessimistic, I apologize, because I think Ed Kerr is probably more right than I am about the potential for gas development in the Cook Inlet.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you very much for presenting, and I'm sure it will spur more questions than answers, but thanks.
Did you pull up your drive?
Yeah.
See you guys Thursday, huh?
Madam Chair.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. I just wanted the committee to know I need to leave real quick for a brief meeting, and
okay.
I shall return.
Okay, and we're going to end at 5 because I have rules
okay.
to...
I will return. Thank you.
Brad. We have Brad from Chugach Electric. Just state your name and your affiliation, and we'd like to hear what you think about the Cook Inlet gas supply.
Good good afternoon.
Thank you. Sorry for the thanks for being patient.
That was really great from Kevin. I'm Bradley Evans. I'm currently CEO of Chugach Electric Association. And just for my background a little bit for people, my father moved from Africa here in 1960, and it's kind of an odd situation, but the family was split at the time. So we've been here for quite some time. I grew up in Fairbanks and graduated from University of Alaska Fairbanks with an electrical engineering degree, and went to work for Chugach after DOT, and spent 9 years up in Fairbanks working for Golden Valley, and now I'm back at Chugach again. So been in the business for quite a while and seen a lot of things come and go, but today I'm here to talk to you about Cook Inlet Gas through the lens of a consumer. So I'm not going to have all the detailed information that Kevin has, and just glad to see that they're working on that. And I have to agree with Representative Ramis that Kevin's one of my favorite people too. He didn't know that though. I think some of this is statements of the obvious. I won't belabor it and won't read it to you. It's vitally important to us, and I think we've done a good job over the history of the Cook Inlet of taking an abundant resource and created an economic engine out of it. It powered South Central. It went up the intertide of Fairbanks. It's served Fort Knox and the Fairbanks area. So there's been a lot of benefit that's come out of that. So it's a critical issue to us. And there's right now currently there's a lot of people involved in this whole thing. And one of the things that we've been after is knowledge and all of those parties in there. We've seen a history of the information's not really shared that much. There's no transparency and the like. So that was one of the things we wanted to pursue, and you'll see that as part of our recommendation, which is already, quite frankly, it's been already started. Our fuel mix today is 90% gas, 10% hydro. In the future, our vision, although there's a, like my dad always said, there's a long ways in between I want and I get. That's an undefined term there, but it's our vision statement, and we think it dovetails with the administration. But obviously, between those two pie charts, there's a lot of time, so the Cook Inlet resource is vitally important to us to make that transition. The way we see this today is supply reservoir harvesting. I guess there's different words for that, but drilling in the same lease, I guess, reservoir. Limited exploration, which I think Kevin clearly identified there. And the supply management, looking from the gas side, it's basically diverting LNG and diverting it back to retail use here in the inlet. On the demand side, we have exports, gas utilities, electric utilities, and military bases. And for demand side management, to date, you know, we've got conservation load interruptions. So where will future gas supply come from? And I think we've all seen these. I know we don't like some of them, but I think when we think about some of these, we don't have the option of turning the lights off while we wait for something to be done. So people may not like some of the alternatives, and the Representative Ramis addressed commercial issues on some of them, and I think those fall down on wherever the economics fall down, because we represent our consumers, and our consumers want affordable power over pride of developing a resource that is more expensive. So that debate continues. I think we identified here the cliff, and then what we saw was this area out here was what could be developed, and I think Kevin explained that quite well. Part of that curve is part of the information he showed you there. The thing that we would like to change on this graph here is that we would like to take the power generation starting back in this time frame through other initiatives, and we'd like to start lowering that so that over the years we're coming down to that part of it and not staying with the trend line that you see there. We think that's part of the solution as well. So our recommendations are continue to pursue a Cook Inlet resource management plan, which I'll talk about here, and then I'd also like to add at least the notion, although I'm not asking anybody to do anything about this, we're going to research this ourselves, looking into a Cook Inlet public gas authority of some entity of some nature to represent consumers in this interest. The Cook Inlet Resource Management Plan, I think you saw Kevin and his group, what they really need to do is they're doing a lot of homework, and right now we need to do a lot of homework to find out, you know, what's in that resource, because there's a lot of capital that needs to be spent in certain areas for exploration, storage, and other resource management activities. So we want to do this through, if we do the right homework, we should be meeting the consumer needs through this. We need to address fuel supply security, because we don't have a lot of options. We'd like to see an increase in transparency. I think today was the first good step for me to see Kevin and his group working on that. I know there's limitations on that, but I think just sharing the information and having all the groups working together on it will increase transparency. This resource management plan is essential. The state's doing a rail belt integrated resource plan. We can't really do that plan without a Cook Inlet resource management plan. It's the fuel input to our plan. If we don't know what the limitations are on the fuel, it's very difficult to do that. And it's nigh impossible to do that. It provides guidance for our investment decisions. You've looked at some issues, and it's been mentioned about storage. We have some storage options we're working on. When the timing of those investments is critical. We don't want to do it ahead. We don't want to do it behind. We think it'll optimize the resource itself out in the Cook Inlet. And we also think, back to the policy questions, it'll provide information for rational policy decisions. And we think that's kind of the goals and objectives of a Cook Inlet Resource Management Plan. That's not the scope of the plan. We think we need to get together and work on that together. We've had a good working relationship here with the administration. We see the administration taking the lead on this. I think a lot of the work that Kevin's doing now is playing into that, and we've had good working relationships with Joe Balash, and they're taking this very seriously. We would like to see a few things added to it now that we've got some traction, because I've been writing about this for quite some time, and I'm glad to see that Alaskans are paying attention to Alaskans for a change. And I think we need a steering committee would be a good thing. And I don't mean a steering committee to tell Kevin what to do, but a steering committee so that everybody is sort of assured that the information is good. We felt like we've done our homework. We felt like we've done the right work to start with, and that we share that information. We had a steering committee on the REGA process, the Rural Belt Energy Grid Authority, that Norm Roepberg got the money for that. And we had a steering committee on that. And quite frankly, I think that's a useful process, because all of these parties begin to understand the troubles and the trials and tribulations of all the other parties. And from that, you get better decisions. I don't know that we need funding from the legislature. I think that's going to have to come out of the administration saying, what's it going to take to put this whole thing together? And I think that, you know, we should put a scope out there that includes reporting back to people to assure people that there's some transparency in this process. This is something that I think from the consumer side, we're interested in at least looking at this very strongly. There are organizations out there that combine the interest of consumers. There's a large gas authority in the southern United States. It's a nonprofit gas agency. It engages in wholesale contracts and all sorts of activities for end users. And we propose that the members could include the electric and gas utilities, at least as a starting point. I'm not here to say that everybody needs to join this. I'm saying it's a model that we might want to look at to make sure that when we look at the resource management plan, that the interest of the consumer is aligned. I know there's been a lot of proposals that say that we're going to force this much gas through this pipe or whatever, and everybody's going to take it, and how do you balance that all out? It would probably be a wise decision to have that balancing not be 40 people in the room, but you're balancing the interest of the consumer against the producer, against the state, so it doesn't have to be overly complicated, but sort of a unifying that consumer interest. So that's the direction we were going to head, but I'm here to support Kevin's effort there. We're dependent on Cook Inlet Natural Gas, and we will be for some time. We'd like to keep things affordable during the transition period, so there's been a fairness debate going on, and I think we're all well aware of that. The gas demand is now apparently outpacing the deliverability supply, but as Kevin showed you on that graph, that was an average annual number, and we're pursuing lots of demand reduction from our side of the equation. And one of the things we want to make sure that everybody is aware of, but from our perspective, and I'm glad to see that the legislative body, just in general, is very engaged still on energy. I was worried that people would relax a little bit as world energy prices came down, that we thought, well, we can wait. And I don't think we can wait. I think that would be a very unwise thing. I think we need to address this issue and keep our eye on the ball and continue to work on it till the problem is solved. I don't want to wake up again and be in the shape we were here recently. I think we've got time to solve these things with different economic drivers that are happening out there right now, but I don't think they should lessen our sense of urgency on it. And I guess with that, I'll take questions.
Any questions from the committee members? Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Co-Chair Millett. And I think I've expressed this to you privately, but in terms of making energy a very important issue in this building, the Capitol, I think your efforts, along with the Chugach's, is a key component of making sure that finding affordable energy for Alaska is a front burner issue as opposed to a back burner issue, assuming that the fuel prices continue to be low. So I applaud you for your efforts, but I guess my question is sort of a one-on-one question. How big is Chugach in terms of customers relative to ALMP and then the other four big utilities, just sort of a ballpark number?
Well, we're around 80,000 meters, and I've actually got that here. Let me see if I can dig that out for you so I can speak more accurately to that. I've got a graph in here somewhere with our numbers. I think MLMP is around 40,000 so meters for those two. G&T wise, we represent about 60% of the energy produced in the rail belt.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Go ahead,
so in terms of customer base, is that the same breakdown then?
Well, we have retail and wholesale, so our retail meters not all the meters that we serve. We serve Homer. I believe they're around 40,000, and MEA. I'm trying to look for their numbers. I have them in here somewhere. Here we go. I'm sorry I don't have this up here on the slide, but through our retail, wholesale, economy energy customer base is 200,000 meters.
Okay. So thank you.
But, you know, we don't continue, you know, like an economy energy like the Fairbanks, we don't continuously serve them, but we produce energy for that many meters at some point in time. And each one of those contracts is slightly different, like Homer's partial requirement and MEA's all requirements. So it starts with our own retail of about 80,000 meters and goes up from there.
Representative Edgman.
How big is GVA relative to the number?
Their load right now, I believe, is around they peak at about 200 megawatts. And they should be around 40,000. Yeah, there's just a little over 40,000 meters. Now, you got to bear in mind that meters is not necessarily the customer count either, because some people have more than one meter. So your customers normally will be less than your meters.
Yeah, I'll stop there. Thanks.
Sure?
I do have some. I'll be more than glad to share. I can give you all this here. It's got the relative size.
And we do have someone online. Mr. Posey, did you want to give us some comments?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman. I appreciate what was presented to you by Mr. Banks, a favorite person by a lot of people, but I would like to make sure that everyone understands that the business as usual.
Can you just state your name and your affiliation for the record? Yeah. Sorry.
James Posey, Municipal Light and Power, General Manager here in Anchorage, because we have other things to do today. But the whole process that we're going about looking at the Cook Inlet needs to be turbocharged. I think that Mr. Evans there is really, really nice, but we do have a problem that if we don't resolve in 3 years, we're going to have some real problems if we don't find new gas. Harvesting the old fields is something the companies that own gas know how to do. They're spending $40, $60, $80 million a year trying to do it. But we need to put the state in front of that engine to make sure that we look for another TCF of gas to get us to where a bullet line or a line from the North Slope or LNG import can grant us some security beyond 2020. But that period between 2014 and 2020, I worry about. I've been in the oil and gas business and energy business now for over 40 years, and I see that the gas dream, that is the gas pipeline dream, I started working on Prudhoe Bay in 1975, thinking that we'd have a gas line in 1987. We're still waiting on it. So it is important for the state to play a role in the Cook Inlet exploration, and I think that whatever that role is that the administration sees fit to do is going to require some allocation of resources. And if we talk about it for this year in the interim and take action next year and the year after, we can forestall some tight times for us and make sure that our industrial base and population base is secure in knowing that we can keep the lights on and the homes warm. And to that end, that'll be the end of what I have to say, other than looking at the structure map. There are some areas in federal lands that are prospective. I like that trend line, but we have to do more than look at it. We need to be working as state and private interest in opening up some of the federal land onshore and making sure that a jackup rig comes in and drills some of those things offshore in order to look for that TCF to 4 TCF that may be still left in the inlet. And then we can work the other problems and waiting for the market to bring the pipelines to us from the north in a fashion that can be relatively economic. And economic, let me tell you, I've looked at numbers for the 30 years I've been waiting for gas off the North Slope, and they've been up and down each and every time. I don't think it costs us that much to look for and find gas in the inlet. That's it.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Posey. Just a question on the comprehensive Cook Inlet Resource Management Plan. Are you in favor of something that Bradley explained to us?
Through the chair, you know, I Brad and I share giving this presentation off and on. We share the passion in knowing that we need to have a resource plan. I'm just saying that I think we need to move much, much faster. It may take some dedication of real resource dollars in the tunes of $10, $20 million to make sure that we secure supplies of gas for our domestic use of home heating and home lighting. And with that, we can make sure that our economic engines that exist in South Central will continue to function.
Okay. Is there any questions for James Posey? No? Thank you very much, Mr. Posey. I appreciate you staying online and listening to our presentation. Any questions for Bradley? Okay, with that, we will adjourn the House Special Committee on Energy. We'll be back here Thursday to hear resolution on AGEA at 3 o'clock. So thanks. We're adjourned.